From the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, this is the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast. Coming up on the program,
we're going to talk all about canning. Do's, don'ts, what you need to know, what you don't need to know before getting started this season.
Mike Novak with his environmental report, Where's the Bees? Your questions, our answers.
And we got Mike Podlesny, he's all about gardening. He's a great gardening podcaster.
All that and more coming up right now.
Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is permeating into your ears with your host, Joey Bear.
And it could be the weeds. Some gardeners try to get all the weeds out of their garden. Other gardeners leave them in their garden. It's really a decision that you need to make. There's benefits to both sides of that. It's just something that you need to figure out what you want to do for your garden.
And Holly Bear.
Canning is a science. When you're canning, you want to make sure you follow the directions, follow the recipe, don't cut corners. Don't replace things. It's crucial to you, your health, and your family.
They're professional gardeners with full-time jobs, and they're on the air.
Welcome
now
to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast, a podcast for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. I am your host, Joy Barron. Beside me is my wife, co-host, best friend, and gardening partner,
Holly Bear.
Behind the TWVG microphone here in the WI Garden Media Studios in Southeast Wisconsin. The information you're going to hear is important and vital to your garden. You just may have to tweak some of the dates and times you applied for your particular growing area. If you're tuning in for the very first time, we appreciate you. Welcome to the program. If you've been with us for all 24 episodes this year and last year, welcome back. You can go to our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and find the podcast tab at the top of the page. And that, click on it, that'll list those who support us, our sponsors, as well as all previous episodes that we have done, the guests and the topics that we have covered. We've had guests from all over North America that has given us loads of information. If you are tuning in for the very first time and you really don't know who we are and you stumbled upon us, welcome. And Holly's going to tell you a little bit about who we are, what we do, and then we're going to get into about canning, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, and all the things that go along with it.
So what we do is we at the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, we have many videos on gardening, canning, what to do with the food you grow, reusing items, all that great stuff. Then we also have our quarterly digital magazines, and those are free, and they're full color, and you can download them, you can print them out, and they're available on our website. And then we also have this podcast.
As well as you can always submit a question to us through our website. You'll find a big red button on the right-hand side if you are on a desktop or a PC or a computer. You can enter that. It's a little more navigable. You'll have to do on your mobile device. But you'll be able to find and send us a question. You can also contact us through our social media sites if you have a question and you feel that's an easier way to deliver that question to us. We'll answer it back to you, as well as we'll address it on the program for others who may also have that same question. Well, as we get into the summer months, it's getting close, or it's time to prepare to can that food that we have worked so hard to grow. Now, Holly is an award, multi-year award winner at the Wisconsin State Fair on canning, and she knows more about canning than I'm aware of, because she's taking classes. I just grew up with it. I don't know all the ins and outs. I know the basis of the operation. But we're going to go over some of the things that, if you're a new canner, if you're an intermediate canner, if you're an advanced canner, by the time we get done with this, we'll all be on the same page so we can be safer and be more effective and know what we can and can't do when it comes to preserving the food that we grow. So what is the first thing we need to know about canning if we're no matter what level we're at?
Sure. So you want to think about what you want to can, what your plans are. So if you decide, okay, a lot of people are starting to go strawberry picking. Maybe you want to make jam. Maybe you want to make pie filling. You want to make sure you have the ingredients, you have a recipe, and that you have the equipment. And that's what's important. Sometimes you'll see sales starting now until through the fall on things like canning jars, pectin, lids, all that good stuff. So you want to pay attention to that. Especially hardware stores, they'll put ads out and they'll have that stuff on sale. But then there's also things like lemon juice, vinegar, sugar, spices that you may need depending on what you're going to can. And that's good to keep track of as well. If you need mustard seed and all of a sudden you start your process, you've got some cucumbers, you want to make some pickles, and you're like, oh crap, I don't have any mustard seed. Well, you kind of want to plan ahead for that. Same thing with like pickling spice, whatnot.
One of the things that maybe some of the intermediate or even advanced canners will go through their stock supply of jars, rings, and lids, and see that they have a number of lids that have not, that's the flat portion, that's not the ring, mm-hmm. that's there's a two-piece system there, that they've had for several years. Are those still usable, and at what time period do you... No matter, even if they've never been out of the box, do you say, don't use them, buy new? And also, this kind of goes into don't buy more than what you're going to need,
right.
Obviously.
I guess it depends. You know, if you look at it and it looks like that orange-ish color.
Gasket, rubber gasket.
Yeah, if it's, like, kind of cracked, if it looks really dry, then I wouldn't use it. If it still looks intact, then why not? You can always reprocess things if you have to, but... You know, or if sometimes you'll find, I remember we found some, you know, you could take your thumbnail and feel it, and if it still feels kind of soft and gummy, that's good. If it feels tough, that's not good.
Right. So that's one thing. Now, there are, what we're speaking of, the metal lids, there are reusable plastic lids, but the gaskets are not reusable. You have to get new gaskets each year, which minimizes the throwaway or the recycle factor, but you just can't. You're not supposed to reuse lids over and over again, or use, let's say, an old pickle jar that fits on a canning jar and and use that as a makeshift lid.
Now, you can use jars for freezing. You can reuse those lids for freezing to or dry storage.
But not for the reprocessing.
For the canning.
What size, you know, we've got a number of different size jars. People have them, a half gallon, pint, half pint, quart. What is the most commonly used? Or it, maybe if somebody's getting into this and they're going to go, hey, I'm going to go out and get some jars. What size should they get? And where are some of the best places that one can get jars at and feel very confident they got a good deal on?
Sure. So you want to think about what you're going to can. If you're making jams and jellies, then you probably want half pints.
There's a lot of jelly in a quart jar.
Yeah, that's a lot of jelly in a quart jar. But if you got a family of 10, maybe you want all that jelly.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So if you eat jelly every day, then why not? If you are making like syrups, things like that, again, you want to do like a half pint. If you're making salsa and you know, it's just one or two of you and you're not going to eat all the salsa really quickly, then you do a pint. If you're canning spaghetti sauce, any sort of sauce-ish, that's a quart jar.
Soup
is a quart jar as well. Whole fruit, like, or whole or even sliced fruit, like peaches, tomatoes, pears, quart, you can use a quart jar. Pickles, most of the time people do quart jars. Same thing for, like, asparagus. Now, things like, you gotta kind of think about, once you open this jar, obviously, you can put it, if you have leftovers or whatever, you can put it in the fridge for a couple days. But if you, like Joey and I, we're not going to necessarily eat a whole pint of salsa in one sitting.
Now, we'll eat a whole pint of peaches or pears, but not salsa.
Right. So that's something to think about. Think about what you're going to eat. Or, like, normally for us, spaghetti, we'll use about a quart jar. It just kind of depends. So
does it make sense to go on the realm of... I'll make three or four half pint jar pint jars versus two quart jars, just so I, you know, if, in the process of I may open two, I may open one, just so you don't have that quarter of a jar or half a jar left. Does that make sense that somebody would process more of the smaller jars because they may not want to open a large jar and have that sitting around for a period of time before they would use it again?
Yeah. Or sometimes the recipe will tell you, it'll say process in quart jars, process in pint jars, so then that's what you want to follow, especially if you're new. And so then think to yourself, okay, you can always go back and get more, and you can always look around at different things like rummage sales, Craigslist, all those places like that.
But maybe. Just not any glass jar
no.
is...
You want to use mason yeah. jars. Right. And, yeah. So, you can also find them at some grocery stores. You can find them at hardware stores. You can find them at home improvement stores like Menards.
And each year that you can, the price goes down because you're not buying them.
Right.
If you spend $10 this year, next year technically you spent $5. The year after that you technically spent $2.50
yeah.
because you're not buying the jar over and over
when
again.
Joey and I started canning, our first jars we bought together were new. And I remember I was like, oh my goodness, how much does this cost? And I wasn't like freaking out, but I was just like...
You were very aware of the cost.
I was very aware of the cost. But now that was like... 5-6 years ago, and I couldn't even tell you how much we spent on those jars. And then we've also found some at rummage sales, and you may even have like a coworker or somebody at your church or a neighbor, family member who has probably a basement full of jars, for all you know, and you could find out from them. So if this is a new hobby to you, don't be afraid to tell people, because you don't know. You might find somebody who's got a whole ton of jars somewhere.
So now you went to a rummage sale. They had 80 jars, you decide to buy all of them because you figure you can get a better deal in bulk besides buying 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some quart jars and pint jars of the old blue style mixed in there. Let's say out of the 80 jars, you have 10 or 15 blue ones because they just cleaned out the whole house from an elderly individual that passed away. Are those old blue jars, would you recommend canning them or not?
I would not. They probably are a little bit past their prime. So I wouldn't recommend canning them. I would just put them on a shelf somewhere, pack them up somewhere, just hold on to them. You probably could try to sell them if you wanted to. We use ours for vases sometimes. They're just, I don't know, we have them on a shelf too because I like how they look.
Now we're talking about the old style. There
yeah.
are new versions of
right.
this.
Yeah, you can tell a difference. The new version looks more like a turquoise-ish blue, and then the old ones are a lighter blue.
Well, let's get back to the... size of jars, because I know people are going, well, what about the half-gallon jar? Can't I can tomatoes or peppers or whatever in those? Because Grandma and Grandpa did that years ago on the old homestead. Can you use half-gallon jars? Is it recommended to safely can and preserve in half-gallon jars?
No. You can only do apple juice and grape juice in half-gallon jars safely.
And that's courtesy of the... United States Department of...
The National Center for Home Food Preservation.
Now, they put out rules not to annoy you, but to keep you alive.
Yeah. So...
Just because Aunt Velma did it in 1947 doesn't mean it was safe in 1947.
Right.
It was still as dangerous as it would be today, but they didn't know any better back then. So, keep that in mind.
Right. So, yeah.
What other things does a beginner canner, intermediate canner, what recommendations would you go with in finding recipes that are reliable for them to follow the directions? They just don't want to go digging through a cupboard or looking online at random canning recipes, do they?
No, I would recommend a book. Better Homes and Gardens has one called You Can Can. There's a Ball Blue book. There's... another book by Ball, it's A Complete Guide to Home Food Preserving. You can find those. The National Center for Home Food Preservation has great recipes on their website. If you have a master canner in the area, you can ask them. You could contact your local extension office. They would be able to get in contact with that person. And,
And if you're looking to can a item and you cannot find that recipe in those books that you reference, there's probably a pretty good reason why, and you probably shouldn't can that item that you're trying to can.
Right.
Okay, and what are some of the biggest mistakes that all levels of canners make that you've seen that people's emailed us with questions or that you have learned yourself? What are some of the mistakes that, no matter what level of canner you are, can occur or you may just bypass and forget about and stuff happens?
One thing that happens a lot of times is people will, like we broke a jar once because we were putting hot food into room temperature jars and then putting that into the canner. So the jar broke. So basically just not thinking about certain steps a lot of times will cause problems. So if you get overconfident,
rush.
not pay attention, you know.
Distracted.
Rush is a big thing. You know, you're like, I want to get this done.
That's when bad things happen.
That's when bad things happen. So, I understand that. I understand the wanting to get stuff done and just be done. But at the same time, you're dealing with food that you're going to eat. So, yeah, that's another one thing to keep in mind. Another thing is doing questionable things. Okay, well, I'm going to make this pasta sauce, and I just happen to have a couple mushrooms laying around. I'm going to toss them in there. That's not good. You don't want to do that. Just follow the recipe.
Even though some people do it, it's not because they're following a certified recipe through the Home Food Preservation website. It's because they decided that they were going to make up their own little thing because they wanted to preserve fill in the blank. And somehow, fortunately, at this point in their life, they haven't killed themselves from getting botulism by canning irregular stuff.
Just so you know, you're probably thinking, oh, nobody gets botulism anymore. That's not true. There was a case probably about a year ago in Colorado. Somebody brought a home canned item that they did not can properly, and people got botulism. So, just, you know, it's still out there. Just because it's 2016 doesn't mean you're not safe from it. So keep that in mind.
So before we go to break and get Mike Novak in here, one more thing. In preserving the food, you've got a water bath canner, you've got a pressure canner, you can refrigerate can these items.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk briefly about all three of those. What would be the easiest? What's the more advanced of the three?
I wouldn't say one is easiest over the other. I think I started with water bath canning. That's what most people start with. So water bath canning is for high acid foods, tomatoes, fruit, things that are sugary, things that you're going to add sugar to, or you're going to pickle. So, like, you can pickle beets, you can pickle cucumbers, you can pickle
asparagus, Swiss chard stems. That was not a good. We didn't do nothing wrong. They just was a horrible. It was like pickling celery.
Yeah, it was gross.
It was terrible.
So that's for water bath canning. That's like when you add acid or add a lot of sugar. Pressure canning is for low acid foods, so you don't have to add any sugar or vinegar or anything like that. So that's things like green beans, carrots, potatoes.
Pumpkin. Potatoes.
Certain soups. So, yeah, so that's the difference. You'll know when you read the recipe, it'll tell you. And
green beans used to be able to water bath green beans. Now that has changed. Pressure canning is what is recommended for that.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick about refrigerator. Obviously, pressure canning, water bath canning, prolonged life of storage,
mm-hmm.
refrigerator, pickling. You can't can those low-acid items in the refrigerator, but you can pickle items, but they have a much shorter shelf life.
Right. They're usually a couple months at that point, but a lot of people like to do that. They like the really super fresh pickles that you can refrigerate or pickle. Or like refrigerated jam.
And whenever you pressure can or water bath can these items correctly, what are we looking at shelf life? How long can these things sit on the shelf before you, one, need to consume them, or two, you've got to dump them?
For best flavor and freshness, they say a year. You can stretch that out a little bit, you know, 2 to 3 years. But you want to start to, like, say you've got something in the back, you've had there for a year and a half. You want to start thinking about eating that.
So with that being said, you can always send your questions via the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com website under that big red button that says question if you have any questions regarding canning, what you can and can't can. We'll be right back after these messages with our good friend, Mike Novak.
A gardener knows that the key to a good plant is its roots. With poor roots, the end result is not good. Conventional pots and trays cause roots to wrap around and become root-bound. Then you try to unwrap the roots at the time of planting, hoping not to break them. But never again with the Root Maker, a non-chemical innovation that naturally air prunes roots to create more vigorous roots. Never a root-bound plant again. Whether trees, flowers, or edibles, home gardener, or commercial grower, more roots means healthier, more productive plants. To get your own, visit rootmaker.com.
What you say? You say Nasala Kombucha. It'll put some glide in your stride and some pep in your step. Nasala Kombucha. Yeah.
Nasala. Sala kombucha makes your body happy. Nesala kombucha makes your body smile.
At DollarSeed.com, all of our seeds are only a dollar a pack. And we have online resources that teach you all about the rewarding hobby of growing your own plants, flowers, herbs, and vegetables. Imagine the joy you'll feel when your children actually help you harvest your first garden crop. Or the pride of knowing you'll never need a florist again. Visit DollarSeed.com and grow a little magic of your own for just a dollar. DollarSeed.com. What could be healthier?
Now back to two environmentally conscious organic gardeners.
If you spray chemicals on your garden to get rid of those bad bugs, those chemicals are not, they don't just kill the bad bugs. They kill all the bugs in your garden. And without having a balanced ecosystem, your plants and your particular growing zone can suffer.
Joey and Holly Baird.
Welcome back to the program. If you want to go and check out our sponsors, them at the WisconsinVegetableGarden.com. You can go ahead and check them out and support them as they support us.
Well, let's go to the Windy City and bring in our regular appearance by Mr. Mike Novak. Mike Novak brings us our environmental report each and every program, and he sounds pretty professional by doing it, too. So Mike's going to talk about what is happening to our bees. And here is Mike Novak.
And now to a man who's not afraid to tell you what you need to do to keep the planet he lives on clean.
Take your food scraps out to your compost pile. Screw in a compact fluorescent light bulb. Turn on a window fan instead of an air conditioner. Low flow, baby. Shower heads and toilets. Take one napkin at Starbucks instead of six.
Mike Novak.
Welcome to another installment of the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Environmental Report. I'm Mike Novak, and you can hear me live each Sunday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time on Q4 Radio, which streams at www.quenumeral4.org. You can also get my podcasts online at mikenovak.net. Now, unless you've been hiding under a rock like a roly-poly, you know that the last decade has not been particularly kind to our honeybees. Something that was originally called colony collapse disorder, or CCD, has now seemed to morph into a chronic problem where each spring we hold our collective breath and wait to see how many bees made it through the winter. This year we barely had time to exhale when we were told that American beekeepers lost about 44% of their colonies between April of 2015 and April of 2016. Given that beekeepers collectively say that they can successfully sustain roughly an 18 or 19% loss and stay in business, and given that pollination is responsible for about $15 billion with a B dollars of our food economy, this cannot be a good development. It's important to note that we're talking about managed colonies of European honeybees. Those bees, or Apis mellifera, are not native to North America. As for native bees and pollinators, we really can't say how they're doing because we don't really have any numbers about those insects. We know they're out there, bumblebees and mason bees and the roughly 4,000 native North American bees, but because they're not in managed colonies like Apis mellifera, we don't have numbers, which, as I can tell you, makes bee counters, a little nervous. Meanwhile, why exactly are we losing our honeybees? If you come up with the answer, you might make a lot of money. I've been talking to scientists and beekeepers for about a decade now, and most of them agree that persistent exposure to pesticides plays a role in this disturbing trend. However, they will also tell you that there are other factors, such as uneven nutrition, parasites like the varroa mite, viruses, and other factors that have a cumulative effect on bees. And yet, I continue to have emails drop into my inbox from organizations that proclaim breathlessly that they have the smoking gun. It's usually a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which have achieved notoriety because of their widespread use on commodity crops. However, they are also used in home landscapes, and that's where a new study comes in. The Purdue University study, just published in the journal Nature Communications, is cause for many of us to look in the mirror. Researchers collected pollen from Indiana honeybee hives at three sites over 16 weeks to learn which pollen sources honeybees use throughout the season and whether they are contaminated with pesticides. What they found was disturbing. It turns out that even if the hives were near crop fields, the bees foraging took them to other places as well. And scientists were able to identify residues in the pollen from about 32 different pesticides spanning 9 chemical classes, including neonicotinoids. So farmers are not off the hook. But the highest concentrations of pesticides in bee pollen were pyrethroids, which are typically used to control mosquitoes and other nuisance pests in households. Guess what? That's you and me. Well, maybe you, because I don't spray anything ever. But a lot of you think that you have to wipe out mosquitoes and hornets and grubs, so you reach for whatever is on the shelves of the big box stores or the local garden centers. And guess who pays for it? Yep, our bees. This is just one peer-reviewed study, but it's a good reason to look in the mirror when you start blaming everybody else around you for the demise of our honeybees. Most of you probably don't remember the great comic strip Pogo, but at one point, the main character, Pogo, sagely quipped, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." That's the state of our environment today. I hope you catch the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio. And by the way, Q4 is now streaming live on Facebook. So you can catch me Sunday mornings between 9 and 11 a.m. by going to Facebook and Q4 Radio, which is Q-U-E-4 Radio. I hope you join me then. You can also go to my website, MikeNovak.net. Go green or go home.
Well, with that being said, we might need to just look in the mirror before we grab some toxic spray to try to get rid of bugs on our property and the side effects is affecting our honeybees. So it's time for question and answer, and we've got a couple of them here. We go to a number of garden centers and libraries, and we've got a whole talking tour this summer, and you can find out if you're in the Milwaukee or surrounding areas. You can go to the website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and click on the Come See Us tab, and we've got a list of all the locations we're going to be, all for free. We're going to be at the State Fair, Wisconsin State Fair, Washington County Fair, and we got a big tour going on for different talks this summer. So with those talks, a lot of the individuals who come, they have questions. We answer them, and they also provide, we ask them to write down their questions so we can answer the questions on the program here for you, because you may be dealing with that same type of problem. So we're going to ask some of these questions, we're going to answer some of these questions right now. So what is your first question here?
Sure. So it says, I have tried growing cauliflower a number of times, and the leaves never stay
covered
over the head, and the plant gets sunburned and ugly. What can I do? How do you avoid the cabbage family worm?
Okay, so a couple of things here. Cabbage family worm, she's growing cauliflower, which is supposed to be that white bleached head of the cauliflower. Now, the way you do it, there's different varieties that are self-bleaching. Other varieties, you have to take the leaves and physically wrap the leaf over top of the head and wrap it with a string or rubber band to prevent the sun from getting to that head of cabbage and causing it to get sunburned. A lot of the commercial growers will do this. They'll hire people and walk through the field and wrap the cauliflower head to prevent the sunburn of the actual head. But you got to be cautious of this because you got to know when the it's ready to harvest, because you just can't leave it covered. You got to remove the leaves and then pop the head off. The other thing, avoid the worm or the moth.
Well, it says worm.
Worm, okay. One thing you can do is cover your cauliflower, your broccoli, or your cabbage patch with a netting with very small holes in it to prevent the moth from getting in there and laying the eggs, which creates the worm that eats a lot of the cabbage, mm-hmm. the broccoli, the cauliflower. So is there another question on there, or is that wrap that one up?
Wraps up.
All right, so another question that we have is...
Okay, this talks about seed tape.
Okay.
We talked about seed tape. If you're not familiar with what seed tape is, it's basically a not really necessarily tape, but it's a long, thin piece of
toilet paper,
and you plant like carrots and radishes this way, and it's effective because it spaces them apart for you. Saves you some steps.
You can do this in a cold winter night, and what normally would take you a minute, let's pick a number, 3 minutes to plant a row, you can do it in about 40 seconds with seed tape. What's the question?
So, can you do the toilet paper tape method with any seed?
Yes, you could. Basically, the method for seed tape is usually utilized for small seeds, your carrot seeds, your lettuce seeds, your radish seeds, ones that are beet seeds, the ones that are very difficult to space. I would see no sense in doing it for peppers or tomatoes because you start them prior to putting them out in the garden. Pumpkin seeds, squash seeds are very large. Bean seeds are very large. You wouldn't need to do it with those. But any small seed, yes. Based on the size of the seed, it can get very tricky to keep the seed tape intact with the weight of the large seed. So it will work for many seeds, but it's really recommended for those very small seeds that are hard to space properly and minimizes the need to go back to thin the rows out. What else you got?
Okay. Putting what to put under pots for drainage.
Okay. Many people have containers on their patio, porch, or deck, and when you water them, water runs out of the container and stains the material. So you can use drain pans. You could use large saucers, large plates on them to catch the water. Mm-hmm. Very inexpensive to go to the home garden center and pick up these plastic trays where the pot sets in them. So that's something that you can do. Now, if you just set them, if you don't care and let the water run down from your balcony onto your neighbor's property, that's your business. But it would be best to have some. And the benefit of that is it catches the excess water, and that water will wick back up into the container. So you can kind of keep the water, the soil moist.
I did that once.
You did that what? You watered plants and it sprayed down on the neighbor's property?
Yeah, when I lived downtown, I had a little house plant thing and I would water it and I didn't realize it was running down. And then one time he saw me in the hallway and he's like, can you not do that? And I was like, oh.
So that was before you were a gardener?
Well, it was like in between.
Okay.
Okay. Sugar snap
peas? Sugar snap peas. Yeah, go ahead with that.
Do I need something for sugar snap peas to climb up? It's best for them. They like to climb, and it helps get them off the ground. It helps them grow, and it's easy to find them. And
sugar snap peas become very heavy, heavily weighted when they have their pea pods developed on the plant. And without a structure, they will fall over and snap the stem or pinch the stem, and they will die. And you'll get very minimal crop. So if you can allow them to grow up a trellis, a tomato cage, string, a fence, something, that will greatly help them to prolong their life, put more fruit, more pea pods on, so you can get a better harvest. So yes, that was one of the few things that we that was only the only thing we ever trellised on the farm was peas.
Best way to keep weeds down.
Okay. Weeds are the enemy of the gardener, so you can use a number of different methods of weed control. One, harmful chemicals. Two, you can spray them with Avenger, mm-hmm. Organic Weed Killer, which is one of the primary sponsors here on the program. Not that we're picking on them or saying that they're the best sponsor that we have. It's simply we are talking about weed control, so we're going to talk about Avenger. Mm-hmm. It has a nice citrus aroma. It's very earth-friendly. You can plant directly after you spray. It's great. You can use a mulch. Mulches. Mm-hmm. The biggest way to control weeds is prevent weeds from going to seed in the garden. Now, you're going to have certain amount of seeds blow in, drop in from birds, or be brought in by you as you're traveling amongst your garden. So preventing the seeds from going to, or the plants from going to seed, because seeds that fall in your garden can lay dormant for 7 to 70 years. And then you go in there and disturb the soil and these start to germinate. Another way to reduce the number of weeds is physically go in there with a fork when the soil is relatively damp, not dry or soggy, and actually work the garden bed, removing all root follicles all the way. And the reason for this is many of the grasses that grow in our garden, I don't know about yours, but in our garden, you rip them out and you don't get the root, and the root will regerminate or grow that top, that foliage. Mm-hmm. Even if you get 95% of the root and you leave an inch in the ground, that inch of root will restart growing again. We've seen it happen a number of times. So what we've done is we're working beds, and the way our garden is set up is they're raised berms. They're not boards or anything, but it's a one-foot walk path, 3-foot bed, one-foot walk path, etc. And we add compost and organic material each year to those beds. One is easier to manage than a large garden. More psychologically, it's easier. Hey, all I got to do is work this one bed. But removing, getting that, loosen that soil up, getting all those roots out of it as much as possible to greatly reduce the number of weeds that will come back throughout the summer and next year. It's a tedious job, but once you do it, you're really reducing the number of weeds that you have coming back in your garden.
Right. Okay.
And that's what we're doing this year over and over, working the roots out of the, or getting the roots out of the garden. One more question?
Sure. Okay, keeping rabbits away using... they eat the seedlings.
Eat the seedlings. So,
yeah. So we had told them, I think, to use the pepper.
You can use a pepper spray, or you can grind up your cayenne or your jalapenos or your habanero peppers into a powder. You want to do this outside or when family or friends are around that you don't like, because it will be very toxic, very aromatic.
Not toxic.
Aromatic in the air. It'll burn. Yeah. It'll burn. And you can make a liquid spray out of this and spray your plants, and they won't want to ingest it. This also works for squirrels, and sometimes it works for deers. I'm not certain all the time for deers. You can also put a fence around it. CedarCreekOrganics.com has products that will greatly reduce the, based on the fragrance and the taste, will keep the animals out. Also, Remington, Winchester, and Mossberg make great tools that will eliminate the animals. But most municipalities or neighbors do not like you using those tools to eliminate the animals in your garden. For those of you who don't get that joke, those are firearm companies. So any other questions, or does that wrap it up?
I think that's pretty much it.
So we appreciate the questions that were provided for us. If you have questions that you have and need addressed, again, website, question button on the right-hand side. If you are on a mobile device, you might have to do a little searching, but it is there. And we'll be right back with...
We're going to have Mike Podlesny, popular gardening podcaster.
All right after this. Water is our most important resource. The key is to capture the rain that falls on your property. No need for bulky rain barrels that are hard to handle and just don't fit in. Rain Reserve has solved the problem for you. With their multi-size and color cube-like units, a rain barrel that does not look like one. Capturing rain, easy, going unnoticed by passerbyers, and blending into the surrounding. Construction so easy, even children can put it together. To get your Rain Reserve, visit rainreserve.com and use coupon code RAIN2016 to save 10% on total purchase. What you feed your plants and soil matters. Tomatoes should be big and juicy, but not at the soil's expense. Age-old growth, bloom, kelp, and fish and seaweed reliable fertilizers, gardens by supplying the plants and the soil with fast-acting nutrients and natural ingredients to create delicious plants and healthy soil. If you desire juicy tomatoes and healthy soil to grow them in, visit ageold.com for more information on AgeOld and our suppliers.
Do you want your next raised beds to be easy, functional, and beautiful? The Embrace helps you create the garden you've always wanted. Finally, raised beds that everyone can assemble and enjoy. No tools needed. Just slide any lumber into the Embrace corner, fill with your favorite soil mix, and you're ready to plant. Made from 100% recycled steel right here in the USA. And a portion of every sale helps to build school and community gardens all across the country. Let the Embrace help you create your next raised bed. Grow beautifully with the Embrace. Available at local garden centers and online at artofthegarden.net.
Hey there, this is Hugh Richards from the YouTube channel Hugh's Nursery, which teaches you how you can grow organic vegetables cheaply and easily at home. You're currently listening to Joey and Holly Baird on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener podcast.
Welcome back to the program. If you want to find out more information about the sponsors you've just heard and our entire sponsor lineup, you can find that at our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. Well, Holly, let's go up to New Jersey and talk with a fellow podcaster, author, and gardener.
All right, so Mike Podlesny is the author of The Vegetable Gardening for the Average Person, A Guide to Vegetable Gardening for the Rest of Us. He's also the moderator for the largest gardening Facebook page and the creator of the Seeds of the Month Club. He's been a gardener since he was a kid, a span of over about 30 years.
Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Well, very glad you've taken time out of your busy day to join us. Now, as Holly talked about in the introduction, you started gardening as a child. Now, was this something that you wanted to do, or was it one of these things that, hey, you come out, you're going to help us type of family time thing?
I think it was a combination of both. I was little. I was young, and I would see my dad out there working. So, you know, being a typical kid who wants to kind of mimic what their dad does, I went out there, and at the time, you know, I thought I was helping, but I was probably more just getting in his way. But that process actually got me even more interested in gardening and just kind of being part of the dirt and learning what he did to grow his own vegetables. And it just grew from there, from that point on. And I've been hooked on gardening ever since, and I love every bit of it. And I have two young kids of my own now, so I try to convey that to them, and they seem to be responding very well because they come out and help me as well.
Fantastic. Now, how many square feet are you growing in, and how do you utilize the space you have to get the most production in a small space?
Well, the exact square foot, I don't have a number on, but I would say I probably take up about half of my property just growing between the garden itself and the fruit trees. It's quite a good amount of space. I have a lot of raised beds, so I do a lot of separation with my raised beds. We have a lot of clay in our soil, and I tried just doing it without the raised beds, just mixing a lot of compost, and it was just taking too long and just too much compost. I was using more compost than I could actually make, so I didn't want to invest a lot of money in buying it when it's something I know I can make myself. So I built some raised beds, and it was just easier and quicker to get it done that way. So about half my property, and then another quarter of my property I have chickens, so that's taken up with that. And I honestly hate mowing the lawn, so if it were up to me alone, my entire property would be a vegetable garden, but my wife would veto that right away.
Now, you say a good chunk of your property is vegetable gardening. We're just talking backyard. We're not talking front yard, are we?
Well, most of it's in the back. In the front, I do have some things growing, but they're more for ornamental reasons, even though they're edible. I mean, it's kale and spinaches and things like that, but it's arranged in such a way so that it looks more aesthetically pleasing than it is, you know, something I would go out and pick. Yeah, the rabbits end up eating most of it anyway, but I also do a little bit out there as I do some experimentation because I have a lot more shade up front, and I have a great amount of sun in the back, so it's mostly in the back.
Now, with you having that much garden, does all the are like the neighbors kind of like, that's the crazy gardener guy, or do they embrace you and ask you questions about, hey, I've got a problem with this, or can you help me with that, or how is that relationship with the neighbors?
Well, right now it's been great. I will say that at first I was the crazy gardener guy, like, oh my goodness, he's He's growing all this stuff, and it's funny that you asked that because my neighbor next door to me, he came over to me, this is a few years ago, and he's like, I never envisioned living next to a guy that would turn his yard into a farm. And, you know, he said it jokingly, and over the years, people, they do come up, and now they start asking me questions, and a bunch of my neighbors have gotten into gardening from seeing that what I'm doing, and I'm by no means, you know, the be-all, end-all expert. I'm learning every day myself, but the neighbors come over, and I give them some tips and some pointers, and they kind of take it to a whole new level. I've learned a lot of things off my neighbors, what they're doing, too, and it's grown, and I wouldn't say I kind of was the pioneer in my neighborhood. Some other people had some gardens, but I just noticed I get a lot more people that come over to my house, and they'll ask questions, what are you growing, how are you doing it, that sort of thing. It's been great, and we've turned into this really tight-knit community in our neighborhood where more and more people are gardening and more people are growing their own food. And another good part about that is I have neighbors, they'll grow, you know, let's say, cucumbers, and no tomatoes, and well, another neighbor will grow tomatoes and no cucumbers, and everybody swaps. And this way you can try different things, and because some people do have limited space that they can garden in. So that's been a real positive with the whole process as well.
Great. Now, you have two sons, and since you had grown up gardening, are they interested in gardening? Do you get them interested in gardening? Are they curious at all, or how do you get them involved?
Yeah, I mean, they're not as serious as I am, but they do some. I've kind of taken it to a new level with not only gardening, but podcasting and, you know, writing a book and all that. So I've taken it to a whole new level than what they would do. But I absolutely do kind of enjoy that way. And they're more of like the reserve gardener who just, you know, want to grow some things and just kind of do their own thing.
Now, you brought up the podcasting and you've got a tremendous following on the Facebook page. Let's talk about the podcasting. Many people do podcasting. Some do very well. Some do it for fun, and others, you know, let's be honest, are not very good at it. You're very successful at it. What got you into the podcasting world? What inspired you? What was your vision going into it, or did you even have a vision?
You know, that's a good question, Joe. I had a vision of I wanted to put information out there on gardening that I would consider the advice that I would use in my own garden. And when it first starts, if you go back to the early episodes of my podcast, it's basically just me speaking, just some tips and tricks and things like that. And then a couple of people had mentioned, you know, you should probably do some interviews. And then I started interviewing some people, just, you know, what you guys do on your show. And it took off from there. I really enjoy speaking with experts in the field and interviewing people and learning from them. And it just kind of took off from there. And yeah, I've done very well. I'm very fortunate. You know, I have a lot of people that email me. I really enjoy the show. I get people that, you know, give me critiques of the show as well. And that helps me change kind of the direction I take the show in. And that's really helped that as well. And as you know, because you guys do it and you interview a lot of great guests yourself, and it's a lot of fun when you're speaking with somebody else who shares that same passion for gardening that you do. And it just makes the show a lot easier. I just had on my show, and I don't know if you guys interviewed him, but a gentleman by the name of Craig LaHoulier. And it was, I had never met the guy before. He was recommended by a couple people to interview because he's the author of Epic Tomatoes and another book on straw bale gardening. And when I was talking to him, it felt like I knew him my whole life. Like, it was that kind of conversation. And it's conversations like that that just kind of, you know, keep me wanting to do this every week. It's just very, I'm very passionate about it.
Right. And whether you're talking to a famous, well-known gardener or someone that's not so well-known, that passion and that knowledge is always there. And they always, no matter whom it is, you're learning something from them on almost a weekly basis.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I've talked to people who I wouldn't say were as well-known, and, you know, they've turned out to be some of the best interviews because they do things differently than I do, and I learn something. And that's kind of what I really try to get across to anybody who listens to the show, is I don't know everything. I don't pretend to know everything. I'm never going to know everything. So when I get guests on the show from, you know, Miami or up in Minnesota or out in California, everybody gardens a little bit differently. And when they tell me how they garden and the certain things that they do, and I'm sure, I mean, you guys are out in Wisconsin, you probably garden a completely different way than we do in New Jersey. And when I learn those new things, I just get so fascinated with it because I lived in Jersey my whole life, so I've only really gardened the one way. And when I hear other, ways that people are doing things, I just think it's just wild and fascinating.
Great. Now, you've talked to gardeners across North America. Are there any creative tips that you've picked up along the way that you found successful in your garden?
I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Joe Lample. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him.
Yeah.
We spent a show one time, and a lot of it was actually off the air, where he was filling me in on all kinds of different ways that he composts to make enough compost for his whole garden. I think he's got a few acres. And so I use a lot of those techniques with the composting that he gave, just different ways to set up the bins and moving it and turning it. And after you hear it, you're like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. But I wasn't really thinking kind of that mindset. I was, at the time, more of a composter. I just throw my stuff in a pile and, turn it over once in a while. But he kind of gave me, like, this series of where you kind of do it in stages. And I also learned, I interviewed another person by the name of Sean Coronado, who does a really nice job of mixing container gardening with gardens that are aesthetically pleasing, so that you set it up and not only is it functional as a garden for food, but it's also one that looks appealing. It's not an eyesore. And if you go to her site or watch some of her shows on, I think she does a series on Fox out in Chicago. And I learned a lot from her. And it's been one week after another learning different things like that. And I won't say I've implemented them all, but I've implemented a lot. And I interviewed a gentleman from Stark Brothers Nursery who was giving me tips on how to care for fruit trees. And I have a bunch of fruit trees, and that's come in handy, especially like the pruning tips and stuff like that. So I have actually implemented, some of the stuff that I learned week in and week out. Some of the stuff I don't, because it's meant more for the area that you live in. So somebody who lives down in Miami is going to do things differently in the heat than I would do up here. So, it works out well for me. I learn a lot, and it's just been a great experience.
Now, we all face challenges in the garden. We're no different. I'm sure you're no different. What has been one of the Achilles heels for you and your garden over the years?
Rabbits. And I say it emphatically. I'm telling you guys, I think I have super rabbits here in my yard. I've had fences, I've tried every trick in the book, and they always seem to get in. Last year I did a lot better. I had some rabbit damage, but not a lot. It just seems every year my fences get bigger and the rabbits just jump higher. I don't know how to explain it, but over the years, it's just been the rabbits, and one of these days I'm going to win that battle, I hopefully.
Well, when we talk about rabbit repellents at expos and talking opportunities, Remington and Winchester make great tools, and about half the guests understand that joke, and the other half are writing it down going, I got to look into this thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's a good tip. I mean, I'll have to look into that.
Now, you said you've got chickens now. Was this something that you have wanted to do for a while? And is it like gardening? It's one of these things that you just continually learn and learn and learn. And what was some of the initial beginning, problems you had faced with chickens?
The chickens is something I've been wanting to do for quite some time. And it was something that my wife really didn't want to do. And I actually just took the plunge. I went out and I bought little chicks and decided I was going to do it. So the early part was, and I had no experience other than reading a couple of books, maybe talking to some people that had chickens. And so the early part of the challenges were, okay, now I have these baby chicks. What do I do? How do I take care of them? And so I had to learn real quick. The learning curve was fast. So we have, the agricultural stores near us are called Agways, so I would go over there, and I would bend that guy's ear for a while, and he would tell me certain things to do. So I learned that. Then the next challenge was, well, they're going to need a place to live. So I had to build a coop. I looked at either buying one, and they were very expensive. And I went online, I downloaded some plans, and I ended up building it myself, which, I'm not a Mr. Construction, but it did a pretty decent job. I mean, it's holding up over 3 years now, so... and then I had to fence in an area because we have a lot of hawks around here, and the last thing I wanted to do was get these chicks and then have them, you know, get picked off by hawks one by one. So those were the early goings. Once I got everything settled in and I started learning different things, and it just became almost second nature. You kind of just, it's like taking care of a pet almost. I mean, a little bit more involved in that, but yeah, you have to make sure they have water and they have food and you're keeping the coop clean and whatnot. And at first it was a lot of work because I wasn't used to it, but now I've kind of settled into a routine and it's worked out really well. I have six hens, and right now they're actually, the show's being recorded at a good time because we're getting a ton of eggs right now. So it's been great. I wouldn't change anything. I think I picked the best breed after I did my research for our area. It's working really well for us.
Great. No, we want to thank you for coming on the program today, Mike. And also, where can people find you if they want to find your podcast or your Facebook page? What's the best way for them to find you?
The best way to get a hold of me is go to the website. It's averagepersongardening.com. And the podcast, you'll see the link up there. It'll be for a podcast. But if you just want to go there directly, it's averagepersongardening.com/podcast. I do have a contact page. Feel free to email me. You know, we have a Facebook page that you mentioned a couple of times. We have a little over a quarter of a million followers on the Facebook page. And, I can't respond to everybody. I mean, I'm getting thousands of posts up there a day, but I do go monitor it and try to respond, you know, as best I can. But if you have any direct questions for me or want to learn more, the best way of what we do, the best way to do that is go right to the contact page and you can send me an email directly. And I do answer all my emails personally. So, feel free to email me.
Well, thank you, Mike, very much for coming on the program and sharing your knowledge and some of the information that you have on podcasting chickens and gardening up there in New Jersey.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for having me on. I appreciate it. Have a good gardening season in Wisconsin.
Thank you, and we'll be right back after this.
Looking for a fast-acting, non-toxic weed killer for your organic garden? One that works in cool and cloudy conditions as low as 40 degrees and is highly biodegradable with visible results in less than 2 hours? Then look no more. Avenger Weed Killer has it all and more. Made from oranges, Avenger is highly effective, easy to use, and has a pleasant citrus aroma. It is OMRI listed and approved for organic gardeners under the USDA's National Organic Program. Avenger Weed Killer is a choice for organic gardeners and homeowners who are looking for an effective, safe way to control unwanted weeds. Available in ready-to-use sprays and concentrate, ask your local lawn and garden supplier for Avenger Weed Killer. For more information and a list of suppliers, visit AvengerOrganics.com. Avenger Weed Killer, eco-friendly, deadly to weeds.
It's all about the soil at ManureT.com. With their grass-fed, antibiotic, and growth hormone-free cattle and horses, owner Annie Haven puts the quality in her premium soil conditioner. 100% organic and natural, whether feeding your flowers or veggies, indoors or out, you can grow organically with confidence. To purchase authentic Haven brand manure tea, small orders or large, go to ManureT.com. Always free shipping.
If you could double the life of your raised bed boxes by sealing the wood with a non-toxic wood preservative, would you? Well, now you can with a clear, penetrating product called Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's 100% non-toxic and easy to apply. Seal your bare, untreated wood surfaces, even chicken coops, by spraying Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's invisible, seals the wood from the inside out, and never wears off. Recommended by organic gardening experts. Internal Wood Stabilizer. Check it out at TimberProCoatings.com.
Hi, this is Nikki Jabor, author of The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener and Groundbreaking Food Gardens, which you can find at NikkiJabor.com. And you're listening to Joey and Holly Baird on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast.
Welcome back to the program. If you'd like to find out more information about the sponsor you've just heard, our entire sponsor lineup, they're great people, great companies, and they appreciate what you do for them and what they do for us. Find their information on our website underneath the podcast tab, as well as their links are in the show notes below. Well, we got one more thing before we get out of here. We've got Gardening in 2 Minutes. Gardening in 2 Minutes is an audio production that Holly and I produce on a weekly basis for a couple of radio programs and a handful of podcasts. If you'd like Gardening in 2 Minutes on your particular program, contact us through the website. And this, Gardening in 2 Minutes, is all about...
mulch, mulch, mulch. How to retain moisture in your garden with mulch.
And here is Gardening in 2 Minutes. This is Gardening in 2 Minutes. One of the ways that you can save water in your garden is by utilizing free resources that you already have on your property and using them as mulch.
Mulch is a great way to keep the water. And one thing you can use is leaves. We collect ours in the fall. We collect all around our yard. Sometimes if the neighbor has some, we'll collect leaves and we just put a sprinkling of leaves over each one of our garden areas, and that helps retain a lot of the moisture.
You can use dry grass clippings that you're currently mowing from your yard. You want to make sure they're dry, so if you bag them, put them on a pavement to let them dry, or let them dry on walk paths in your garden and utilize them around your plants. Two things you want to keep in mind when utilizing dry grass clippings as mulch is, one, make sure you cut your grass to where there's no seed pods on the grass blades that you would be bringing into the garden. This is, you're just adding weeds, seeds to the garden, and you're going against what you're trying to do is having a weed-free garden, as well as make sure your yard hasn't been treated with any chemicals, because that will retain in the grass clippings, and you'll introduce that into your garden, which can be very detrimental to the vegetables that you're growing.
You can also use shredded paper. While this might not be the most attractive looking mulch, if you have a shredder and you have the paper that you shred, you can definitely use it. You may want to water it down a little bit when you first put it on your plant so it doesn't blow all around.
You can also use straw. The straw is the byproduct of the grain industry, oat straw, wheat straw. You don't want to use hay. Hay is grasses that are grown for animal consumption that contains a lot of weed seeds. You could also use pine needles. Pine needles are acidic, but by the time they break down in your garden, they become neutralized and will not affect the pH in your garden soil. For more information on mulches and the advantages that mulch can have in your garden, our weekly video productions, as well as our free downloadable digital quarterly magazine, you can find all that information at
thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.
A gardener for all gardeners. For Gardening in 2 Minutes, I'm Joy Baird.
And I'm Holly Baird.
So if you've never used mulch, and we didn't use mulch for about the first 3 years before we really understood how this whole thing fell into place, and we never used mulch on the farm either. That was just something we never did. It's something you want to look into. A lot of good information, a lot of free resources that you can utilize, and it really helps retain the moisture in addition to using an irrigation system. Well, that will wrap it up for the program. We greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day to download the program, share it with your friends, and we hope you take away something. And again, if you're questioning about what to can, it's probably best that you don't do it, or you get some information before you go in and make a mistake or hurt yourself. So the audio provided, the audio in the podcast is provided by sfx.co.uk and audioneutronics.com, two royalty-free and copyright-free websites we use to help liven up the podcast.
Except for Nasala Kombucha and Dollar C provide their own audio.
Until next time, I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
And we will see you in the garden.
The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is a production of thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide, and distributed in association with WI Garden Media.